It's Tuesday, January 3rd, and this is Geek Nights. Tonight, we talk about Dungeons & Dragons with our special guest and Dungeon Master, Alex.
Let's do this!
So, I fell asleep at my desk not once, not twice, but three times today.
Is that a record?
It's not a record, but actually, I fall asleep at my desk fairly often, but it was particularly auspicious because I stayed up all night geeking, and that was why.
So I stayed up all night geeking, but it was so weird that I just kind of woke up this morning better than usual, better than average.
Honestly, when I woke up, I didn't expect you to, you know, actually be at work. I expect you to look out the window, see the sleet, and just give up.
See, I probably would have given up, except for the fact that when I went to push the snow off my car, it just kind of went right off. Even though it was heavy, but like it didn't have to scrape.
Well, the snow got worse later as opposed to earlier, which was odd.
Yeah, that's not what the weather said.
But anyway, our crazy party, as you all know, is over, but the last survivor is still here. So we have a special guest, Alex, our dungeon master, who will be joining us after the interlude and things of the day.
Yeah, and not dungeon master like actual dungeon of torturing.
Yeah, not the sadomasochism thing.
Yeah, the other kind.
Yeah, the dungeons that have dragons in them kind.
But not real dragons.
Oh, they're real enough.
Ow, that would hurt.
They do various D's worth of damage.
D's. All right, so Intel, you know, those people who make chips that we don't buy so often, or, you know, ever, they're, well, not only are they going to be in the new Apple computer, supposedly, but they finally got rid of Intel Inside.
Really?
I mean, like, when was the first time you heard Intel Inside? Like, Pentium 1s?
Yeah, I think it was Pentium 1s. I remember seeing the commercials and seeing the stickers on computers.
Yeah. Yeah, they're changing the logo, too. It's still a blue swirly, but it's a different blue swirly. And they're even saying they're going to get rid of the word Pentium.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people who, the word Pentium to them means processor.
Yep. But that's not how it's going to, it's kind of like Band-Aid, but yeah, I guess that's going to change now.
I wonder if this has anything to do with the fact that Apple doesn't want the Intel logo on their pretty not square, not beige boxes.
That's what some people are saying, is that Intel would love to have Intel Inside all over every freaking Mac, but I don't think Apple's going to let that happen, and that's one thing people are pointing out.
You know, I'd love to see like the actual agreement between Intel and Apple that led to this switching to Intel.
I really think that all agreements between all major corporations need to be like public things that everyone can see.
I imagine there are parts that are hilarious because people like us don't get to read them.
That might be. Another thing a lot of people pointed out that's not so well known is that Microsoft and Bill Gates really don't like Intel, and Intel really doesn't like Microsoft.
Yeah, well, it's not for the reasons you'd expect.
It's mostly that Intel doesn't like Microsoft because, you know, Intel makes a chip, and they like to add features to the chip. Like, they added MMX, then they added SSE, then they added SSE2, right? Now, think back in time. When Intel had a 32-bit chip, the Pentiums, right? The Microsoft operating system, Windows, was a 16-bit operating system. Then Microsoft made a 32-bit operating system. Then Intel made a 64-bit chip, that Itanium that didn't go anywhere. Did Microsoft make a 64-bit operating system?
Kinda.
No. But they got one that's going to work with the AMDs that's going to come out. Is it out? I don't even know the status of that.
AMD did it right. I mean, basically Intel decided, all right, x86 has been extended to the point of stupid, and we're going to make a new architecture, kinda. And AMD said, you know what? We're just going to extend x86. To 64-bit.
Yeah, if you ever actually code an x86 assembly language, you're kind of on Intel's side. But other than that, you know, from a business sense,
or just from a realistic point of view, it's really hard to introduce a new chip that's not at all backward compatible with the rest of the world.
Yeah. But actually, I heard that Bill Gates once or currently still owns many, many shares of AMD. You know, so there's something going on there.
Well, but think about it. Buying a computer with an AMD processor gets you a faster computer for a lot less money. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot more money to spend on a Windows license, and Windows seems faster, and you feel like you got a better deal.
Yep. Well, the final piece of the puzzle is that apparently, like, Dell and Microsoft are kind of fighting a little bit, too. So it's like, if Intel and Microsoft are fighting, and Dell and Microsoft are fighting, you know, who knows? That whole Dell-Wintel kind of action might all break apart in a few months.
Yeah, wouldn't it be hilarious if we ended up back on PowerPC?
That would be so great.
Except we won't because PowerPC chips are really expensive.
I see a future where Dell releases computers with AMD chips in them and you have a choice of getting Windows or not.
I could see that.
I could definitely see that. And I could see Apple with the Intels. I could see people running Windows on those.
Yeah, I also see a lot of people running Linux on new Apple hardware.
Oh, well, you ran Linux on old Apple hardware with PPCs. They're going to run it even easier on the new stuff.
Yeah. More importantly, things like Wine will work as opposed to before.
There's a lot of talk about that. It seems sort of rumorish, though, that you're basically going to be able to run Windows applications on the Intel Macs, just like you double-click them and they run, the same way that OS 9 applications seem to just run in OS X.
Wow, that would be kind of amazing.
Yep, I might get a Mac if they do that.
I'll be
first in line for a PowerBook if it does that.
For anyone who's ever tried to use Wine to make programs work, like Windows programs work in Linux, it's pretty much just completely hit or miss, and there's very little you can actually do. Mm-hmm. It's either it works or it just crashes with random obscure like stack dumps.
Yeah, right now you can do it with virtual PC, but that's like a money thing, and you need a Windows disk, and you need a Windows license and all that.
But, yeah, or VMware, but it's the same deal, and you also have to pay for VMware.
Yeah, who knows what Apple's working on back there, so... We'll soon find out.
Might be a rumor. Like the infinite number of rumors that are just completely made up every day about all this.
Yeah, none of the stuff that we say on this podcast is 100% guaranteed because we get most of it just by reading websites, and who can trust any of that?
Yeah, look, we link to Slashdot more than any other site.
Do we really?
Yeah, we do.
We should go do some statistics on that.
Yeah, we could.
Anyway, so in The Escapist this week, which... seems to have gotten better a little bit, even though I didn't read the full articles.
Like, neither one of us read it today, and we were talking about it, and we were making fun of The Escapist, like, you know what? There's going to be an article about a girl gamer who's oppressed, and then there's going to be an article about EVE Online, and then there's going to be an article that makes a good light of some stupid subculture that no one else cares about.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one of those.
Oh, great.
But it was about game stores this week. You know, the GameStops and the EBs and the independent guys and...
Yeah, a lot about how the margins are real tight for these stores.
Mm-hmm.
They really make all their money off the used games.
Now, I knew the margins were tight, and that's why they love the pre-orders, because when you pre-order a game, they know they've sold it, and it's a guaranteed profit.
Plus, you're going to be in that store not once, but twice, and you might buy a used game in that interim.
Yep, you go, you're going to pre-order it, then you're going to leave, then you're going to come back, and you're going to buy the game. That's two visits. Who knows what you're going to buy during those two visits?
Plus, a lot of people are real dumb. They'll buy, like, 10 new games... And then after they beat them all, they'll take them all over to EB, sell them back for a pittance to buy, like, one more new game.
Yep.
Then EB sells all those games for, like, 10% off of the original retail price. They make a pile of money, and then someone sells it back to them again.
Mm-hmm. As someone who doesn't sell games back ever, no matter how crappy they are, but buys used games, I don't really care if the game store makes money. I get the used games cheap and, you know.
Yep.
I think you're dumb if you sell them back.
Remember Funko Land back in the day? It was the first game store that was kind of like... It's like it was the predecessor, the precursor to like modern EBs and GameStops.
Yep.
And basically, like the whole gimmick was that Funko Land had consoles out and you could just try games before you bought them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had piles of games. You just walk up like, I want to play, blah, and they'd put it in for you and you could play it for as long as you wanted.
Yeah, the only place you could do that was Toys R Us that had the demo machines that would go for 5 minutes.
Yep, but this was like the real deal, just consoles. Like, that's the only way I ever played a Sega Saturn.
Wow.
Because they had one, and I played
a Sega Saturn and a Toys R Us a couple times. That was pretty cool.
Ah. But I remember I had Final Fantasy 1 for the NES,
mm-hmm.
and they always had this sheet in the store, this like the bounties on games. And I looked, and they were willing to pay $35 for a Final Fantasy 1 cartridge.
Wow.
So I went home, and I got it, and I sold my Final Fantasy 1 cartridge to him for $35.
Okay.
And then, like, a month later, I was in that same Funko Land, and I saw Final Fantasy 1 for $15.
And you got it?
And I bought it back.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's why Funko Land's gone.
Yep. Well, that and Funko Land was really kind of ghetto.
Yeah.
We didn't notice as kids, because... We just wanted to play the games. We never actually bought anything, really, but...
Yeah, we never really went to Funko Land, my family. We were just all Toys R Us action, mostly, which was cool, because Toys R Us, you know, had, like, little pieces of paper.
Yep, the wall of pieces of paper, and you'd pick it up, and then you'd go and pay, and then you'd go to that little booth behind the checkout, and you'd give them your little slip, and then they gave you the game.
And all the consoles and hardware were in this glass case, and you walked over to the glass case, and it was like,
Man, my parents hated my little brother and I, because like once a month they take us to Toys R Us. They're like, you guys can buy one game. and we would stand there and debate for like 4 hours.
I was standing there for like an hour walking back and forth trying to find the right game. Sometimes it was hit, sometimes it was missed because I really didn't have much to go on because I wouldn't buy a game that I, you know, my friend had and I didn't really know what to look for and I didn't get a magazine to tell me what to get.
Because I remember once Super Mario 3 and Zelda 2 were both out and we didn't have either one and we could only get one game. There was no way to decide.
I remember having to decide between like Kirby's Adventure and something else. Kind of glad I got Kirby's Adventure. So if you played Counter-Strike before, you know all about the Dust maps. Dust and Dust.
What was
2.
That map called? Dusp? Dusk?
Dust. D U S T, as in the tea you drink.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you haven't played Counter-Strike, you have no idea what the hell we're talking about. But let me just say
there's no one in the world who hasn't played Counter-Strike.
Oh, all right then. It's that map, you know, where it's a bomb map and not a rescue the hostages map.
It's the map everyone plays on. There's freaking crates in the desert.
Yeah. To this day, from the earliest Counter-Strike Beta 5 to the current Counter-Strike Source, it is still the number one map that is played more often. And usually map makers are weird people, or they're hard to find people, you know, and they don't really talk so much and you don't hear about them, or they kill themselves.
Yeah, like there was one map, and I really won't get into it, but it was a stupid map. Like, it was the worst Counter-Strike map I'd ever played. And the guy who made it committed suicide. And because of that, the map got really popular and people like really talked it up, like in homage to him. And you know what? The map was crap. I'm sorry.
I think it's homage, but whatever. Yeah. So you usually don't see too much about map makers, even though it's a really hard job and I've tried to make maps and it is really difficult and it takes mad skill, mostly because there's not a lot of documentation on it.
Yeah, not like the Doom 2 days. You just whip one together.
But the maker of Dust and Dust 2 and some other maps on his website, I think his name is Dave Johnston. It's johnstow.co.uk, has the making of Dust and the making of Dust 2. And if you've ever played Counter-Strike and, you know about the Dust maps, this is a must... burp. This is a absolute must-read. Absolutely must-read. I mean, it's not very long, and just looking at the pictures is like, holy crap. He shows you stuff that you didn't even realize. Like, here's a picture where on the left is Beta 4. And you can see on the close bomb spot, like the two crates where they're positioned. And on the right is CS 1.5. And you can see that two crates have been moved and been rotated diagonally so that when you're planting the bomb, you have more cover. And it's like, oh, wow, you don't even... It's something you don't even notice, even if you play the two games one after the other. But you look at the picture and you're like, wow, a lot goes into map making that is like, you know, totally complicated.
Yep. And tiny little things completely change how a map works.
Yep. I mean, look, he even shows that in Beta 4 and early in such times, they didn't really have shadows. And then you can see CS 1.5, they had shadows. So now all of a sudden, the whole map changes because now what used to be just normal places are now like optimal hiding places. And that might change the whole dynamic of the map, is that you can hide in certain places and things.
So if you've ever played Counter-Strike, read this. It's cool.
Yeah, it's very, very cool.
So I was on FARC today, like I do, and lo and behold, there was a religious flame war, as there always is.
Because those never happen on FARC.
Nah, never.
That's like the rarest thing. Oh, my God.
Now, this one came up. It was some funny story about a judge in Italy is basically some guy sued, and a judge in Italy has ordered a man to prove that Jesus exists.
Way to go, Italy.
I can't wait to see how that trial goes. But in the thread, about three-quarters of the way down, someone posted a funny little comic that basically sums up every FARC flame war about religion ever. And I won't explain it because it's a comic and you can read it, and I found it funny. And it kind of sums up my beliefs regarding that sort of thing.
I think it sums up the beliefs of every rational human being.
Yeah, like the Brights.
Yep.
Not bright as in I'm a bright person, but bright as in that movement of naturalism.
Naturalism.
We should talk about that some Thursday, the Brights.
We should. They're cool.
Yep.
I'm one.
Yeah, I'm not one, but I agree with them.
To be one, all you have to really do is fill out their website.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, whatever.
But, like I said at the beginning, we have our guest, Alex, our current dungeon master, our former live dungeon master, but he doesn't live near us anymore, so we play online. And we've got him here to, well, first do a thing of the day.
Greetings. Well, if you're like me, or in which you're a computer science student, or recently ex-computer science student, or maybe just in general, working at Google has this semi-legendary aura about it. People make up all sorts of stories about how hard it is to get in there. There was the story going around for a while that you need a PhD to actually get hired by Google as a programmer. Not really true, but... So, among the things that Google workers actually get up to is they order quarter tons, that's 250 pounds, of silly putty. Apparently, you can order it in bulk directly from the manufacturer.
Oh, really?
How much does it cost? Do you need Google money, or can you use normal money?
I actually don't know, but I suspect normal money.
Mm.
This was just a couple of the employees decided to do this. Well, by a couple, I mean a couple dozen.
Oh.
And when a couple dozen people place a bulk order for silly putty, what you end up with is a quarter ton of silly putty in the form of about six bricks the size of my torso laying on a guy's desk.
Great.
Wow.
Now, these bricks all stacked up, but you can't take that much silly putty home at once. You got to split it up among all the people who ordered. Problem is, as anyone who's played with silly putty knows, it's much easier to stick together than it is to take apart. And the problem is only magnified when you've got 250 pounds of it. So scissors didn't really work. Knives, not so much. Wrenching and tearing, kinda, but that's like taking fingerfuls off of the mass.
They obviously didn't think this through.
No, yeah. They didn't.
What you'd think they would, being smart Google people.
Perhaps they tried to, but it was overruled by the whimsical impulse to see 250 pounds of silly putty in one place.
I gotta admit, I'd pay a decent sum of money to see that in person.
Yeah, wonder how the silly putty company does it at the factory.
I don't know.
Maybe they just make it in smaller bits, so they don't have to take it apart.
In any case, this has a happy ending. All the employees involved, the couple dozen of them, hacked and gnawed away at this, hopefully not literally, for a couple hours, and they all got their handful of silly putty.
Huh, you know what probably would have worked? Either, like, freezing it and then going at it with, like, a chainsaw or an axe. I think an axe would have worked really well, actually.
Silly putty shards everywhere.
Well, maybe minus the freezing plus the axe.
How about one of those water cutters where it shoots a stream of water that's really sharp because it's moving fast?
Wet silly putty gets mad slimy and scary.
Those water cutters don't make things wet.
Really?
Basically, it shoots a sheet of super pressurized, super concentrated water that acts like an extremely sharp nano knife. They use them to, like, cut pipes in industrial settings.
Maybe.
They're really cool.
All right.
So anyway, after the things of the day, we move on to the main bit, which is Dungeons & Dragons. Uh-huh. And the three of us have been playing Dungeons & Dragons for most of our sentient lives. So we thought we would be a good group to talk about Dungeons & Dragons.
I don't think I've been playing for most of my sentient life.
Well, yeah, you're really, honestly, in our group, you're kind of the newbie.
I've played it in middle school times, which was like 7th grade, so I was 13 and I'm now 20, so almost half of my sentient life.
Wow.
I played it a little in my younger days, but actually I didn't get seriously into it until I got to college, when I finally got together a serious group to play in.
Mm. Wow, you're making me feel old, because I like played first edition. Well, I played Dungeons & Dragons, and then I played Advanced Dungeons & Dragons first edition, and then I converted to second edition, and then I converted to third edition. And I went to cons when I was a little kid. I was like this little kid, and I went to like little cons in Michigan, and there were all these big scary guys, and they all drank Mountain Dew, and they were creepy.
See, we would have done that, but there just weren't enough nerds in my town to do it.
Oh, there weren't. I had to drive, like, hours to get to these little tiny cons.
Oh. Well, I meant for, like, to play D&D at all. Like, if there are three nerds, you really, that's not enough.
Yeah.
And you really, even if you had five nerds, you couldn't get them all together at the same time. It just didn't happen.
So we figured we'd start with the obvious question, what is Dungeons & Dragons?
Because a lot of people have a little misconception about it.
Yeah.
And a lot of stereotypes. And yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there are different ways to play it. Dungeons & Dragons is really just a way of role-playing, as in pick a role and play it, and there are rules to moderate that role-playing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the simplest way to describe it is you say what your character does. That's all you really have to do. Everything else is just semantics.
It's like, you know how kids will have make-believe, and they'll just imagine whatever they want to imagine, you know. They'll read a story, they'll imagine themselves being the character, they'll change the story. You know, who knows what little kids imagine, or what anyone imagines. D&D is just a way where you can imagine in a group, and you put a set of rules to limit your imagination. And if you know anything about imagining, you'll know that creativity is increased when limits are placed on the thinking.
Those limits act as guidelines, and it forces you to think harder about them.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The two major limitations, guidelines, whatever you want to call them, in D&D are the dice. You can declare your character's actions, but there's not always a guarantee of success. And the dungeon master, who, if he or she is doing his or her job, should hopefully be guiding you all towards some kind of plot or providing opportunities for plot.
Yep. I mean, basically, the way the game works, for any of you who have never played it or have only seen, like, television representations of it, is a bunch of geeks sit around in a room, and each one of them is playing a character. And there's one guy, who for us was usually Alex, who is the dungeon master, or the game master. And all they do is adjudicate. They resolve every situation that can't be resolved, like, just with dice automatically, or that just can't be resolved obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if Scott is a thief, and he tries to steal my purse for some reason. And coin purse, not woman purse.
Merce.
And now the dungeon master decides what must be done to decide if that actually happens or not. Maybe he succeeds, maybe he fails, maybe I kill him.
Maybe.
The dungeon master also decides to provide the players with other challenges so that they're not just trying to steal from each other.
Yeah, it'd be pretty boring if it was just four people. You know, that's why you imagine an entire world around the characters.
Unlike most games, D&D isn't really competitive, which is doesn't really fit with the conventional definition of a game, but we've got nothing else better to apply to something that involves all these rules and dice and paper.
There seems to be a lot of people who don't get that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Like, they always ask, so how do I win?
Yep. It's always kind of scary when you see someone, like, they're angry about dying, or, you know, they feel like if they're not winning a fight in D&D that they're kind of losing a game. And it's like, all right, you know, I really don't care which way things go. You know, I try to make it go the most interesting way, not necessarily, or the way that my character would want, you know, things to go. Yeah. Not necessarily towards any winning or losing condition that I might imagine that doesn't exist.
See, it's one thing to get emotionally involved with your character, and that can actually be a good thing, because that makes your role play a little more strongly.
Can also be a very bad thing.
If you get too far, and it can be a very bad thing, because you can't accept that this person who is ultimately badass in your head can lose. Because they're not ultimately badass. If they were ultimately badass, they wouldn't need to wander around doing the piddly little mercenary jobs that make up your standard D&D campaign.
Yeah, that's why those kind of people play those epic games, which are just silly.
Yep. Now, we kept saying Dungeons & Dragons. That's just because that's the game we play. I mean, role-playing is a really broad, very just ephemeral genre of gaming where there's a million different systems and a million different ways to do it. We just happen to use the Dungeons & Dragons system.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really avoiding these things specific to that system. So we're saying Dungeons and Dragons, but take that to mean role-playing in general, I suppose.
Yeah, you can play GURPS or what, White Wolf? Or
Amber. Amber was cool because it didn't use any dice.
Yeah. Or any of those other systems are all pretty much played in the same way. It's just a different set of rules and limitations. And that can modify the way the games come out. In fact, it usually does. But In essence, it's just the same thing. You know, there's a master or game master of some sort and a bunch of characters, and you act out some sort of imaginary world to entertain yourselves.
So why do we play Dungeons & Dragons?
I can tell you why I play Dungeons & Dragons.
Because you get to play things like Mind Flayers and eat people's brains.
Well, that's fun, but the thing is, it's like there really isn't so much adventure going on in the world these days. I mean, I guess there is technically opportunity for adventure. You can, like, join the Peace Corps or something, you know, and go crazy. But not so much when you want to do computers and things. So with D&D, it, like, lets you and your group of friends, like, create stories and have things happen to you that, even though you all know they never really happened, like you talk about them as if they happened. Like, remember that time you did something crazy? And you play D&D so that those crazy things will happen.
Because we seriously do it. We'll be sitting around at dinner talking about the time the characters like had a crazy fun adventure or did something. We tell it just like it's a real story.
Mm-hmm.
Laugh at people's stupid mistakes. Laugh at people's successful things. Here's a laugh at the DM's stupid mistakes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Though I think Scott, when he played, all right, I'm going to do the unholy thing and tell a story from a Dungeons & Dragons game. Now, normally in polite company, one does not do this because the one thing that is the least interesting to anyone else in the world, other than telling someone about your own dream, is telling someone about your Dungeons & Dragons character.
Unless it's the other people who are playing in that game. Then I'd love to hear it.
But to sum up very broadly, we're a bunch of undead people and we're in a desert. Desert wasteland for as far as the horizon goes in all directions. And it's night and half the party's vampires. And Scott is playing a vampire who is not so bright. I don't know if that was a function of Scott or a function of the character.
I think some of each.
It was definitely some of each.
But he ticked off the party to the point that we tried to kill him. And he decided to run away into the desert where there was no shade. And eventually the sun came up. And vampires don't like the sun so much.
Yeah, that wasn't too good.
No.
See, I was when I did that, I was under the false impression that I would be able to make it somewhere before the sun came up, and I was wrong.
Yeah, hence the emphasis on the miles and miles and miles of desert wasteland.
Yeah.
Sort of the punchline of that situation was that, according to the D&D rules, a vampire who dies turns into this mist and goes back to his coffin. The coffin that was still with the party. So, you know, about half an hour after sunrise, you have this vaguely sullen-looking mist. Cloud of fog scrambling along the ground and going into a box to sulk.
I mean, we have a million stories like that. We won't tell them all, but that's really one of the big reasons why we play. It's like it adds a dimension to our friendship that couldn't exist because, like, we all can play video games together, but we can't all kill a dragon together.
Mm.
With D&D, we can.
Yeah, and it doesn't take very long either. I mean, you can sit around one night for like 5 hours and go on like a million-mile, multi-month quest of grand adventure, and it's as if you went on a million-mile, multi-month quest of grand adventure, even though you sat on your ass on your couch and rolled some plastic rocks around.
Yep.
It takes a little longer for my aunt to actually come up with the adventures and the challenges and all that, but not a whole lot longer. And to be honest, I like that kind of stuff. I like coming up with alternate worlds and alternate characters and writing this little story of my own. And then you guys can surprise me with it, so I have all the benefit of both reading and writing a story.
To me, that's the best part of it. It's kind of like you've got a group of friends, and together you're all acting out and writing a novel. And you know what you want to do, but you don't know what everyone else really wants to do. And you can't always predict how people will react or how things will turn out. So you're taking part in this, like, play, but you don't know how the play is going to end. So it's like you're reading a book, but you're writing it at the same time.
It's not even that you're writing a book. It's that you're writing a book. You're writing many books. You're writing the number of books equal to the number of players plus one. The plus one is the DM who's writing a narrative book for the third person, and each player is writing their own first-person book. And they're all separate, but I guess you can put them all together and it'd be like one giant book. You know, because, like, I know, like, the images in my head from, you know, whatever the world was like or whatever adventure looked like, but it's not even close, you know, in words or pictures to what, you know, anyone else thinks of the same exact game. You know, it's just completely different.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we can all talk about it and it's the same, but different.
I suppose we could consider, like, how we actually found out about Dungeons & Dragons or actually got into it in the first place. Because until recently, it's not like Dungeons & Dragons advertised itself. It was just there, and if you knew about it, you knew about it.
I don't even think it advertised itself recently.
Yeah, it does. Lately, Wizards of the Coast has been putting a lot of stuff out. Well, Hasbro now.
Wizards has really tried to popularize it, and with some degree of success.
Yeah. I mean, it was doing real well until everyone who bought the books realized that they never need to buy the books again and there was no more market for the books.
Yeah. I mean, once you know the rules, you don't really need to buy the rules again. You can't really make money off of it because the supplies are non-renewable. And the supplies don't go obsolete either.
And also, you'd be surprised how many pirate sites there are out there that just have, like, PDF scans of every book ever.
Mm.
But, like, how we got into it, I mean, I remember the first D&D I ever played, I was real, real, real young. Like, it was either my last, it was, like, the end of elementary school or the very, very beginning of middle school. And, like, I remember my uncle used to talk about, he used to play Dungeons & Dragons. And I didn't really know what it was, and he didn't play anymore, he didn't have any books, he didn't talk about it a lot, but every now and then he talked about it, and I was curious. And I met some people, I met this kid named Cedrone, and yeah, his name was Cedrone, and he was like, you want to play some D&D? And I went over to his house, and he gave me this book, he was like, make up a character and we'll play. And I guess this was an example of bad D&D, as opposed to good D&D, which we'll probably get into later. Because basically what D&D consisted for these guys was make a character and then kill things with it and make poop jokes.
Wow.
Yeah.
No one in this company makes poop jokes.
At least I don't think anyone's ever made a character that makes a poop joke in character.
Wow, yeah, I couldn't think of one, which was surprising to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to find one, but...
I think it's time to make a character who's a little mature.
So, Scott, how did you get into D&D? We'd never really talked about this, not even outside of the podcast.
Well, let's see. When I was a little, way little, like elementary school ages, there was a... I knew the words Dungeons & Dragons. I knew it was some sort of game. I didn't know much about it at all, and I wasn't really interested in seeking it out. But I was friends with the nerdy kid who lived down the street, and one day he got a game. It said Dungeons & Dragons on it. I was like, all right, whatever. It was this big black box. And inside, there was, like, a bunch of cards and this big board. And the board was, like, this dungeon made of squares. And we never actually played the game. But it wasn't real Dungeons & Dragons. It was, like, Dungeons & Dragons something something.
I remember when that came out.
And it was, like, you would do something, and then someone would take the card out of the box, and it would the box of cards was the dungeon master. And... you know, it wasn't really so much the role-playing as some sort of walk-around-a-dungeon crawl game on a board with little figures.
It was HeroQuest with vaguely D&D-inspired.
Yeah. Nice. We never actually played it, so I'm not 100% sure, but that's just my memory of elementary school.
I think I know the game you're talking about.
Yeah. But then in middle school, I went to this nerdy summer camp, and I was big into magic in those days.
Magic.
Yeah, which I soon learned my lesson on. But anyway... So we'd play Magic at Adventure Games, which was after dinner every day. But after lunch every day, there was a quiet time in the bunk. And I don't know how many bunks did this, but every bunk that I was in when I went to this camp, all the kids played. Each cabin had their own little D&D game after lunch. And I remember the first time I played, they're like, play Dungeons & Dragons. And I was like, all right, I'm finally going to play this freaking thing for real. So I'm like, all right, how do I play? They're like, first you make a character. And they gave me a second edition PHB. And I was like, all right, this tells me nothing. So then someone walked me through the whole thing. And I had like a scrap of piece of paper with some numbers on it. I didn't understand at all. And then I'm like, all right, now how do I play? They're like, you say what you do. And I'm like, oh, that's it? Yep, really, that's it. And then after about two times of saying what I did, I was like, And that was that. The next time I played was, I think, when I went back to the camp again. And then I played it pretty sparsely in high school. And then when I got to college, we went to the RWAG, and well, that was that.
Ah, see, I played it in high school more than I played it any other period in my life, including college.
Wow. Guess that's what happens when you have people. It's all about having people.
The first D&D... product I bought when my first real exposure to the game was actually the second edition Monster Manual. Prior to that, I had this sort of vague conception that the game existed, and I knew very roughly what it involved, but not the details. But I was in a comic book store, which often happens to sell D&D products as well, and I happened to see this book, and what I saw was a book full of a bunch of neat pictures of monsters and descriptions of them.
That's a great book.
And I like monsters for their own parts. So,
I love that book. That's a great
book. I bought it because I was a kid with apparently too much disposable income at the time. And over the next few years, that actually became sort of a source book for the informal half BS role playing that kids do. I think I would have been in, I think, middle school, possibly younger around this time.
While we're getting old, we can't remember when things happened in our lives anymore.
Wow.
And over the course of that, I would gradually meet people occasionally who actually knew the game, and would do these occasional one or two player games. There was just one friend of mine in high school times who actually would do sort of one-on-one D&D, which, unless you can have no other kind, is kind of sucky. That's when I actually learned the second edition rules, and how that actually was supposed to work.
Mm.
And then when I came to college, suddenly I was with a group of 15 other people at RWAG, all in one D&D game.
Yeah, we told you guys that story at least a month or two ago about the crazy D&D game with Dwayne the Dungeon Master.
Yeah, where I discovered, oh, there's a third edition, because it had just come out at that time, and I didn't even know, and yeah.
Yep.
And now third edition is what we still play.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So it was after the Dwayne game kind of fell apart, and we were all sitting around in the cafeteria talking about D&D in some fashion or another, and I basically said, screw it, I'll run a game. I've never done this before, but I'll see how it goes.
And it went real well, I'll tell you what.
Yep. That was some good D's and D's and D's.
Because actually, I mean, like, my first experience with D&D came early, but I didn't play good D&D. I played it and it was fun, but I didn't get it, as in play it with really good people and actually roleplay well, until high school. Or maybe it was right before high school and middle school. I don't remember.
Yeah, that D&D that I played at that summer camp was not good D&D by any stretch of the imagination.
Ah.
Well, I mean, the first year I was there that we played, it was pretty much just terrible. It was like, you know, I was just some cleric and I did healing, and that was pretty much it. There wasn't really so much role-playing going on, so much as like, there are some monsters, we all roll dice. You walk. There are some monsters, we all roll dice. But then it got actually sort of involved when I died and I was reincarnated as an ogre. And then I was like, oh. And then the game kind of changed from there.
Yep.
Into something a little better. And that's when I got the idea of what it was supposed to be like.
Because the first games that were like really, really good is I started playing with a bunch of my friends in high school. And basically we played every Sunday, meaning we'd all like meet around 10 a.m. on Sunday. And then we'd all go out shopping for food. And then we'd play until like school started on Monday.
Well, that's real long.
Yeah, like we'd do 12, 14-hour sessions just nonstop, and then we'd watch anime like right after. We were such geeks. But we really our games really focused on the role playing and very little on game mechanics and combat. Like, it's kind of, this might sound too nerdy or geeky, but we actually had an entire gaming session where the whole thing took place within a ball that someone was putting on. Our characters were just kind of hanging out and chatting.
That's real geeky.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of D&D I like. Fine. I like playing a character.
Well, the thing in D&D is that most of the book is the rules of fighting, because those are the most complex rules, you know.
Well, that and because the origin of D&D is a pure fighting game, and they've kind of hammered it and pushed it into this mold of other things.
Yep, yeah. But, you know, a better way to play D&D that I think is to, you know, you fight when fighting makes sense, and then there are rules for it. But
yep.
That doesn't mean you always, you know, just need to make it a game of fighting. It's a game of role-playing, and when you role-play in an adventure-y world, which is usually what you want to play in, you don't want to play in some boring world like this one.
I mean, I guess it's subjective. I mean, everyone...
Fighting will happen.
If you enjoy playing D&D however you play it, that's great. Because the best thing about the game is you can play it however you want with whoever wants to play it with you. So I might be up for the game of all talking where no one ever fights and it's just people talking to each other. And Scott might like the game that's like a mix. And some fanboy might like the game of I'm an ogre and I smash things in dungeons forever until I stop playing.
Yeah. At least to me, if you want to play that kind of thing, you want to play some kind of little tactical game, D&D's not the best way to do it. There are better games for that.
Yeah.
But if that's your thing, go for it. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are plenty of tactical, like, war games that are not, you know, suit the more abstract war games, because D&D is not an in-depth war game by any stretch. But very few of them have all the creative options of D&D, which is why I think people like to play it. I mean, you play something like Battletech or whatnot, and your options are pretty much like move, shoot, jump, turn, that sort of thing. In D&D, you can come up with crazy stuff, because especially if you're a wizard, you have so many spells, you know, you can, and you have the terrain, and, you know, you can really stretch your imagination within the words of the rule book to do all kinds of things that you can't do in a normal tactical game. And not combat, just, that really comes out.
And not just the words of the rule book. And this is something that I think often leads to the bad versus good D&D, in my opinion, and at least in the opinions of other people I've talked to. Take that for what it's worth. The DM is your final arbiter. The rule book is a guideline. Mm. And as a DM, I often will just scrap a rule if I don't like the way it's going to work. I prefer drama over accuracy. That said, the rules are a starting place. They're a common language that everyone speaks, so everyone knows what they're capable of and what the things they're dealing with are capable of. So try not. I don't try to break them without reason.
Because I see you get like a lot of people who, like, I have friends who say they hate Dungeons and Dragons, and I ask them why, and they explain these games where their dungeon master was like a jerk. And he basically just played a game of, I will never let the players win, and everything they think of, I'll come up with a way to stop it.
So that's HeroQuest. That's not D&D.
Yeah. Yeah. It is not the players versus the dungeon master. That's silly. The dungeon master has absolute control over the world. It's not a challenge for anyone.
Yeah, if the dungeon master wanted, you know, all right, fine. A rock falls from the sky and kills all of you.
Dragon eats you. If you want to play the dungeon master versus the players, there's things that do that, and yeah, they're not Dungeons and Dragons.
Scott mentioned HeroQuest. It's an old board game that is very much designed to be the Dungeon Master versus the players, like, specifically, and it's actually kind of fun.
Yep, but it's not D&D.
Even though the last time we played it, we all died because Scott, in his infinite wisdom, decided to run around a dungeon opening all the doors and waking all the monsters up before we finished fighting one monster.
That's greatly exaggerated story.
Not so much.
Yeah, so much.
All right, fine. The specific story. We were fighting a Chaos Knight, which is this big, bad mofo with an axe. And he was chopping us up, but we were just about to beat him. Scott decided to run off on his own to look for treasure. And he opened a door, and in that room there were two more Death Knights, and they killed him, and then they tracked us down and killed us.
See, it made sense to me that behind that guy... See, I didn't run around all over the dungeon opening doors. I opened a door because it made sense to me the way the dungeon was laid out that this monster was guarding a treasure in the next room, and I was wrong.
No, it was guarding two more monsters.
Yeah, what a great monster guarding two more monsters. So that was just a case of bad luck, but I did not run around opening doors willy-nilly getting monsters to chase me around to
you
where
still
the party
led, was. You caused directly all of our deaths.
You know... In a game that would have made sense, like D&D, those monsters would have heard us fighting in the next room and come in anyway.
No, it makes sense, because in HeroQuest, all the walls are made of magic lead.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Absorbs all sound and energy. Cannot be breached by any means.
Or, you know what? They're Chaos Knights or Death Knights. I imagine the two in the other room probably didn't like the third one, and they left him out there. But then when you open the door, they couldn't hide anymore.
That's another thing I really like about D&D is when you get these tiny bits of flavor that, you know, sometimes you read a fantasy novel or something and you'll get the bits of flavor, but usually not so much because a lot of them are, you know, focused on the main plot and the main characters. In D&D, you can get like you're fighting a couple orcs and maybe one of them is a little silly, or you know, you'll go into a shop to buy something, and the owner will have a silly pet.
Or the dice
will be arranged in a funny way.
Or just, like, the dice will come up with something improbable. Like, someone who should have... Like, some peasant who just should have been whacked doesn't get whacked and creates, like, this funny ongoing joke or this ongoing story that you didn't expect.
Yep. Those are always great things. Because it's like, somehow, as a group, you imagine something without any of you imagining it. Yet, there it is. It's way cool.
The unpredictability keeps it interesting.
Yes. Of course, you really have to play D&D with, like, good people who are going to get into it. Because one jerk in the group can just kind of ruin it. Of course, you can always just kick them out.
Yeah. It's real hard to manage a D&D game, and you can find all sorts of things online about how to keep it good, how to tell which people are good and bad, all this kind of stuff. But it really helps if you do it with a bunch of friends and all the friends are good.
Yep.
If you're doing it with people you don't know, but they're good, it can still be kind of awkward. And if you're doing it with your friends and they're no good, that can, you know, It's I guarantee it's ruined at least one friendship in the history of the world.
Minor rant. It's rather unfortunate how little of the published material by Wizards of the Coast, TSR, whatever. TSR was a little better at this, but not a whole lot. Actually is about how to role play or how to run a good game.
Yeah.
You get some of that in the magazine articles, but it almost never appears in the actual books.
So I guess I never needed instruction. I just like I got it. Like, all right, I'll play a game. I'll role play.
The only instruction I ever got was say what you do, and then all you have to do is realize that you're not you. You're the whatever you made, and then that's it. And if you can't do that, then you're really, you know, it takes practice once you get it, no matter what. But if you don't get it, you know, ever, then there's really it's kind of like a no hope sort of thing.
I mean, I guess it's, if you're one of those people out there who played D&D once and it sucked and you hate it, just try to give it a chance and try to find some people who don't suck, and I think you'll like it a lot. Mm. I mean, I can't imagine many people who wouldn't like Dungeons & Dragons if they actually played it with cool people.
It's not like a video game where you play the video game and if you play it again, it's going to be the same, because a video game is the same every time. Or a song where if you hear the song again, it's not going to be different. This, you know, if you listen to it with different people. But D&D is like 1,000 different things, even though it's all based roughly on the same set of books and such and literature. So that depending on where you play it, with whom you play it, you know, what kind of D&D you're playing, it can be a completely different thing. And, you know, a lot of people are put off of it based on a first experience or a bad experience. And that's kind of sad because they're missing out.
Even though we're kind of missing out right now since we don't all live near each other anymore, and it's real hard to play long distance.
Mm.
Like, we've been experimenting with playing online in forums, and it's working really well, but it's not the same as the experience of sitting in a small, dank college apartment with, like, 9 of your closest friends for 6 hours in a row eating Chinese food and killing dragons.
It's not the same experience as watching your dungeon master sweat as you do the improbable thing that he didn't think of, and he tries to come up with a plausible outcome.
Oh, you mean like 3 sessions into a giant epic campaign naming who the secret bad guy was accidentally? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've learned to keep a very good poker face.
Or coming up with a crazy, crazy scheme to just jump to the end of the game and skip all the carefully prepared plot of the dungeon master, making his efforts wasted in vain.
Like, we were playing in Alex. Alex ran this awesome Requiem game. We're not really get into it, but there was this giant, like, epic artifact building thing, and it was this huge, powerful thing, and it was just a plot device. We were supposed to, like, see it and, like, look at it and figure out what it was, and then it revealed a lot of the plot, and we ran off to do our other things. So way later in the game, we're in a tough spot, and instead of doing the obvious, like, all right, fight your way through or do whatever, we frigging traveled all the way back to this tower and used its awesome power that he didn't think we'd remember to completely circumvent part of the game.
Mm.
Yeah. Showed a bit of a lack of foresight on my part.
My favorite story.
On the other hand, it all turned out well.
Yeah, it did. See, that's the thing. No matter how weird it gets, it always works out because the story concludes itself somehow.
Mm-hmm. My favorite story of D&D where something like that happened was the story of the very powerful druid versus the evil count in the castle. Basically, this evil count in a castle had a evil castle on the like a cliff over an ocean. And the party consisted of a bunch of people and a very powerful druid. And they were going, and there was supposed the DM already had planned out what the inside of the castle looked like, and the whole plot with the evil wizard and these traps and all this great stuff that was going to go on in their quest through the castle to defeat the evil guy. The druid, being very powerful, probably too powerful for this campaign, summoned 2 very, very large earthworm-type things that ate all the dirt under the castle, and the castle fell and sank into the ocean.
I imagine the dungeon master crying.
That's about what happened right there.
Yeah.
And that's just great.
So I guess that's the best thing about D&D.
Mm.
Well, it's improvisation. And the fact that don't let the fact that there are those rules there make it seem otherwise. The rules inspire improvisation much more than they limit it.
I mean, plus, if you play with a good adjudicator or a good dungeon master, you really don't need to know the rules so much as just know your character and just explain what you want to do, and he'll take care of all the rules, and he'll work it all out for you, and then he'll tell you what happens.
So if you're one of those people who has a stereotype of D&D about attacking darkness or drinking Mountain Dew and eating Cheetos.
If there are any girls there, I wanna do them.
I cast magic missile.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, it's overdone, but if you're one of those people, you're only half right, because only half the D&D in the world is played like that. Yeah. The other half is really harder to find because it's hiding from the first half. And it's good, and don't be afraid of it.
Yes, even we who make those inside jokes occasionally, really, that's a minority of it.
Yeah, even though there is a lot of Mountain Dew drinking, that is very prolific among Dungeons & Dragons players for some reason.
In my case, my first D&D, the D&D campaign I ran for you guys, the first one, was powered almost entirely by Snapple Lightning. I think because it had the highest caffeine content per volume of liquid I could get and still stomach.
I remember I went to this Michicon, a gaming convention in Michigan, and I was young and I was there, and I played in a tournament D&D, which it was just normal D&D, but like there was an epic plot and it went on for like multiple days, and the final session was like this 8-hour long session in one room, and it was kind of live action, kind of Dungeons and Dragons, but I remember there was like a soda machine in the room, and it had Mountain Dew in two of the slots. And by the end of the session, not only was the machine empty, but there was an entire tower constructed of Mountain Dew cans surrounding the room.
Mm. I remember I played in one D&D tournament once at the summer camp, actually. It was like a contest held sometime near the end of the session. And it was sort of a solve the puzzles and get to the end of the dungeon the fastest tournament where, you know, they had the same dungeon and they, you know, there were different groups, and it was, you know, if your group could get to the end of the dungeon faster than the other group, then you won. And, you know, there are a bunch of puzzles and things. So it wasn't really so much the role-playing as much the puzzle-solving, but it was still kind of fun, you know, and that's just another way that, you know, you can use D&D to do cool stuff that I remember.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we've gone on about D&D a lot, and this might set the record for the longest podcast ever.
Awesome.
Woohoo!
So, yeah.
That's why you should play D&D, because it's so great that you could just talk about it forever and ever, even though you spent maybe...
I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I don't think you realize out there how hard it was for us to not like actually tell all those stories we were making reference to or thinking about in great detail.
Wouldn't you love to have your own stories?
And that was Geek Nights with Rim and Scott. Special thanks to DJ Pretzel for the opening music.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to point your favorite podcatcher at feeds.feedburner.com/geeknights to get the latest episodes as soon as they're released. Also, please visit our website at www.frontrowcrew.com for the latest updates and forum discussion. And whether you love or hate our podcast, we won't know unless you send your feedback to us at geeknights@gmail.com.